Several of you have experience in your secular jobs of having performance reviews on a regular basis, maybe an annual basis, where you go in and you are with your supervisor and they go through with you your performance over the previous year. And you know it's coming up, and maybe you're kind of anxious about that, and you're concerned maybe with what they're going to say or what has transpired, or maybe you're confident in your performance. And depending upon what has happened over the past year, you may receive some encouraging words from the supervisor. You may have some corrections that you need to make. You may have some things that they see that you need to do better at, etc. And those are the kind of things that will be mentioned during the performance review. In these letters to the churches in Revelation 2 and 3 that we've been looking at, that's kind of what's happening, is that these churches are receiving a performance review from Christ Himself, who is coming to them and saying, this is what is going on. And remember, in the first letter to the church of Ephesus, he says that, I am the one who is standing amongst the lampstands, the lampstands representing each of the congregations. The idea is that he knows what is going on. He is intimately familiar. He is intimately familiar with each congregation and with the works that they are doing, whether they be good, whether they be bad. He is constantly aware of whether they have been faithful to him or not, or whether there is false doctrine in those churches that needs to be rooted out. The question I've been asking as we look at each one of these letters is, what kind of a letter would Jesus write to us at the North Gardendale Church? And while this is taking a corporate look at how our congregation is doing, of course the application has to be made individually as well, because this local congregation is made up of individuals. And our individual work, our individual attitudes, and our individual desire to be pleasing to God will then, of course, affect the church as a whole. We come to Revelation 3 and beginning in verse 7 now, and looking at the church at Philadelphia. There are two churches within these seven churches that he writes to that have nothing bad that he has to say about them. One was the church at Smyrna, which we looked at a few weeks ago, found in Revelation 2, verses 8 through 11. And then this one here in Philadelphia, found here in Revelation 3, verse 7 through 13. And of course, what we would hope as a church at North Gardendale is that if Jesus was to write and send us a letter discussing what he knows about us and what he has in mind for us and what we are doing right, or if there's anything wrong, we would hope that we would receive a letter like the church at Philadelphia received, where he has nothing but commendation for them. This is a letter full of hope. This is a letter full of comfort. This is a letter that is full of that intimacy that you see between Jesus and his people that are faithful to him. And we need, as a congregation, to make sure that this would be the type of letter that we receive. Let's read beginning in Revelation 3 and verse 7. And to the angel of the church in Philadelphia write, these things says he who is holy, he who is true, he who has the key of David, he who opens and no one shuts, and shuts and no one opens. I know your works. See, I have set before you an open door, and no one can shut it. For you have a little strength, have kept my word, and have not denied my name. Indeed, I will make those of the synagogue of Satan who say they are Jews and are not, but lie. Indeed, I will make them come and worship before your feet and to know that I have loved you. Because you have kept my command to persevere, I also will keep you from the hour of trial which shall come upon the whole world to test those who dwell on the earth. Behold, I am coming quickly. Hold fast what you have, that no one may take your crown. He who overcomes, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God, and he shall go out no more. I will write on him the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, the New Jerusalem, which comes down out of heaven from my God. And I will write on him my new name. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. So what is it that the church at Philadelphia got right? There are three things that I want to briefly look at, and I'm actually wanting to look at these in conjunction with each other, all at the same time, and because they are related. And the three things that he lays out for them is that, number one, they kept Christ's word. Number two, they did not deny Jesus. They did not deny his name. And that they persevered through persecution. Now, these are related. They go hand in hand. And I actually want to talk about these in reverse order. And so let's take a look at the third one first. They persevered through persecution. Apparently, as was the case with the church at Smyrna, which was also the other church that Jesus had nothing but good to say about, the persecution, at least the main source of persecution, was from Jewish brethren. Now, we don't know, of course, the complete makeup of the church at Philadelphia, but you would have to imagine that it would be a mixed makeup. There would be Jews, there would be Gentiles. I would assume that there would be a good bit of Jews there as well. The persecution is coming from the Jews. Verse 9, you have the synagogue of Satan, the same term that's applied to the Jewish community in Smyrna and those Jews who were persecuting the Christians there in that church. And the reason why they're called a synagogue of Satan is because though they called Yahweh their father, though they claim to be his people, Jesus is saying they are not my people. They are acting like their father Satan, just as he did with the Jews and what when he was on this earth in John chapter 8. He said that yes, they may be Jews racially, they may be Jews ethnically, by descent, but they are not my people. They claim to be my people, but they are not. And they are the ones who apparently are at least the catalyst for this persecution. And he says that they are causing problems for these Christians here. Now, what was it that was the issue? Why is it that they were persecuting these Christians, or at least stirring up maybe the Roman government to persecute these Christians? We don't know the story. We don't know the history. But one potential aspect of this may be that they were tempting the Jewish Christians specifically to deny Christ and come back to the synagogue, come back to the Jewish faith, come back to what they understood to be part of Israel, be part of God's people. And so this goes hand in hand with the denying Christ. You know, the Jews, of course, did not accept Christ as the Messiah, and so it may have been that the Jews were trying to persuade them to leave this, what they thought, falsehood of Christ as the Messiah. These Jews did not, or these Christians did not do that. Any Jewish Christians among them, they did not deny Jesus. They may have been tempted to do so because of the persecution, but they did not give in to that. And they may have been cast out of the synagogue. We know, we see that in the first century in Scriptures, where the Christians would meet in the synagogue. But as soon as that became a problem, as soon as the Jews had enough of them, they would kick them out of the synagogue. It may have been that there was a temptation to compromise with the culture around them, with the pagan culture around them, and to pay homage to the emperor as a god. That's something that we've noted before in some of these letters. That's something that we know happened in the first century on a regular basis throughout the empire, that Christians were demanded to give homage and to burn incense to the emperor as a god. Not just honor the emperor as the political power, but to proclaim him as deity and to deny Christ as a god. And there is plenty of evidence that many Jews did that in their minds superficially, not really meaning what they were doing. But Jesus didn't take too kindly to that. Because you are not willing to confess his name, he says, then I am not willing to confess your name. And so maybe the Jews were trying to tempt them to compromise and pay homage to the emperor. Maybe the culture around them was getting them to do that or trying to get them to do that, but they persevered through that persecution. Look at what he says in verse 8. He says, you have a little strength. That may be a reference to the fact that they have been through and worn down by this persecution, and they only have a little strength left. It may be they have a little strength just because they're few in number and they don't have much support. But Jesus is offering support. But through it all, they have not denied Jesus. And they have been faithful to Him and they have kept Christ's word through it all. In spite of the pressures, they were determined to obey Christ. They were determined to be faithful to Him no matter what was going on around them. No matter who it was trying to get them to say, come on, just do this, be a part of this over here. Your life will be so much easier. No, they were faithful to the Word of Christ. Look over at John chapter 12, please. John chapter 12, Jesus says this about His words and about the fact that His words were actually Yahweh's words, God's words, that He was sent to speak on His behalf. John chapter 12, beginning in verse 46. Jesus says, I have come as a light into the world that whoever believes in Me should not abide in darkness. And if anyone hears My words and does not believe, I do not judge him, for I did not come to judge the world, but to save the world. He who rejects Me and does not receive My words has that which judges him. The word that I have spoken will judge him in the last day. For I have not spoken on My own authority, but the Father who sent Me gave Me a command, what I should say and what I should speak. And I know that His command is everlasting life. Therefore, whatever I speak, just as the Father has told Me, so I speak. Brethren, Christ's word is going to be what judges us in the last day because it comes straight from the Father. And so His commands and what He tells us that we should be doing and the way we should be living our life, that is what we are to follow, and it is the standard. We live in an age, it's nothing new to humanity, of course, but we live in an age in which we are inundated by people who think that truth is relative and that just whatever you want to do, if it's good for you and doesn't hurt anybody, then that's okay. That makes each one of us God. That kind of thinking makes each one of us the standard and whatever we think that dictates of our own heart, as we looked at in Isaiah last Wednesday night. That's the standard. No, Jesus says, My word is the standard. And He commends these Christians in Philadelphia for obeying His word. He says, you have kept My word. You have been faithful to Me. You've been faithful to what I have said. You have not denied My name and who I am. You have been faithful. Brethren, I don't think, at least I certainly hope not, that in our lifetime that we will live in a similar circumstance as these Christians where they were forced or at least coerced and were trying to being forced to give up Christ completely, to totally deny Him, say that, no, I do not believe that Christ is the Lord, and upon future result of or threat of death. That may or may not happen in our lifetime here. But don't we already have that pressure, even if it doesn't result in some type of bodily harm? Don't you and I experience the same type of peer pressure from our friends or our neighbors or the professors in school or from the people that we work with and just the media? And we are different if we believe in, for instance, traditional biblical marriage. We are different if you go to a public university and you believe in God and creation. And you're made to look like a fool if you believe otherwise. And you are ostracized in circles of society. And there's that temptation from the people around us to just not bring it up. Don't mention those things. Don't ruffle feathers. Don't rock the boat. Go along with what everybody else is saying. Don't make that stand. Brethren, we need to learn from the example of the Christians in Philadelphia of being obedient to His word and not denying His name, regardless of what kind of consequences may follow. And sometimes that temptation to compromise, sometimes that temptation to give in, sometimes that temptation to deny Christ actually comes from our own brethren. If you haven't experienced it, you will. Where you have Christians, those who claim to be followers of Christ, who are not following Him like they should and are trying to get you to go along with that. Just like these Christians, it may have been that you have their brethren in the sense of Jewish brethren trying to get them to deny Christ and go back to the synagogue. It may be that we have situations today where there are those amongst us who influence us in negative ways. From amongst our own brethren, we must be faithful to His word. We must not deny Him. We must take a stand, just as these Christians did. With all the other churches except for Smyrna and this one, the next point that I would have made is, of course, is what they got wrong. This is what they got right. Well, what did they get wrong? Well, there is nothing that Jesus brings up. That doesn't mean that they were perfect. That doesn't mean that they were sinless. That doesn't mean they ever made mistakes. But they certainly were a faithful church, and Jesus commends them for that. However, what I do want to focus on for the rest of our time is the promises that Jesus makes to them. In the other letters to the churches, He always tells them to repent or else. This time, He basically says, keep doing what you're doing. Continue to be faithful. Hold fast to what you have. Continue to do what you have been doing. And so let's take a look at the promises of Jesus that He gives to them. All these comforting words that would have encouraged them that can also be an encouragement to us as well. First of all, He says in the beginning of this letter that He is giving them an open door. We need to take a look at what He says about Himself in verse 7. And the quotation from Isaiah to fully understand what this means. Look at chapter 3 and verse 7 to begin with, where He says, "He who has the key of David, he who opens and no one shuts, and shuts and no one opens." And then in verse 8, He says, "See, I have set before you an open door and no one can shut it." Well, what does that mean? What is all this reference to opening and shutting doors and who has the power to open and shut a door? You may have a footnote or a cross-reference in your Bible that points you to Isaiah 22. Please turn with me there to Isaiah 22. Because if we don't get this and what is happening in Isaiah 22, we're not going to understand what Jesus is talking about here in Revelation 3. In Isaiah 22, beginning actually in verse 15, God is pronouncing judgment upon Shebna, who was an individual in Hezekiah's court. He was an official. And we don't know all the details about what happened, but apparently God was going to remove him from his position. He was going to be replaced by Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah. Look at verse 20. Isaiah 22, verse 20. "Then it shall be in that day that I will call my servant Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah. I will clothe him with your robe," speaking about Shebna, "and strengthen him with your belt. I will commit your responsibility into his hand. He shall be a father to the inhabitants of Jerusalem and to the house of Judah. The key of the house of David I will lay on his shoulder. So he shall open and no one shall shut. And he shall shut and no one shall open. I will fasten him as a peg in a secure place, and he will become a glorious throne to his father's house." Eliakim took Shebna's place. He became, in Hezekiah's kingdom, the highest in command next to Hezekiah. He had power over the kingdom like nobody else except for Hezekiah. He was the one who would give you access to the king or keep you out from seeing the king. If you wanted to talk to the king, you had to go through Eliakim. If you wanted an audience with the king, you had to go through Eliakim. He was the one that would be able to control the kingdom based upon the authority that Hezekiah was giving him, ultimately that God was giving him. And so the key to the house of David was given to him, was on his shoulder. He was the one that had the power to open and shut doors. And he became a glorious throne to his father's house. He wasn't on the throne himself specifically. Hezekiah was, but he was in charge of that. There are typological inferences and indications about a relationship between him and Christ, as we are seeing with Revelation 3. But this is the reference that Jesus is alluding to, that he is quoting from in Revelation chapter 3. And so go back to Revelation 3 and let's make the application what he is trying to say about this. He says that I am the one who has the key of David. I am the one that opens and no one shuts, and shuts and no one opens, and I am giving you an open door and nobody's going to shut it. What is the message that Jesus is saying to these Christians? He is saying that I am the one that can give you access to the Father, and I am opening that door for you, and you may go in. And no one is going to deny you that access to the Father. You are my people. It doesn't matter what anybody else says. It doesn't matter what's happening. Know that you are my people. Know that the Father hears and sees. Know that you can have a presence with Him because of me. I will let you in. I am the one that has the power to open and shut, and I am opening a door for you. Nobody will shut it. That is a tremendous promise, brethren, that you and I can have access to as well. That we have access to the Father through Jesus the Christ, that He is the only way to the Christ, to the Father, of course. I am the way, the truth, and the life, and no one comes to the Father except through me, He says in John 14. That is a wonderful promise. It may not look to the world like we are God's people. It may not look to the world like we have been blessed by God. It may not look to the world that we are the ones who are in the right. But Jesus knows this. God knows this. And He is providing access to the Father. He says He's giving them that open door because they have a little strength and kept my word and not denied my name. That open door to the Father, that provides not only access and an ear to listen to, but it also provides access to His strength. Look over at Ephesians chapter 6, please. Ephesians chapter 6. In this familiar passage about the armor of God, we've made the point before, I want to make it again, about where the strength comes from. It's not an inherent strength when we are doing battle with Satan. It's not our own powers, but rather it's the power of God. Take a look at verse 10. He says, "Finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord and in the power of His might. Put on the whole armor of God." And he goes through and talks about this armor. It's all from God. The strength, the armor, everything we need to survive is from God, not ourselves. You and I cannot make it on our own. You and I cannot battle against Satan and win by ourselves. We have to have that strength from God. And so when Jesus says, "I am opening this door for you," you may have a little strength left. You're going to have access to more of it. You come to the Father through me. And there's vindication as a promise as well. In verse 9, you have the persecution from the Jews, those of the synagogue of Satan, as he calls it. He says, though, in verse 9, "Indeed, I will make them come and worship before your feet and to know that I have loved you." That's vindication. That's making it known to the enemies of these Christians that they were wrong and that the Christians were right in trusting in God. Look over at Psalm 23. That's the point of the last couple of verses of Psalm 23. You know this psalm. And the psalm, which actually goes along with that song that we sang about being the Lamb of God, and that's the picture of most of Psalm 23, is that we are a lamb being led by our shepherd. But at the end of this psalm, in verse 5, he says, "You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You anoint my head with oil. My cup runs over. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever." That's vindication. That's God on behalf of His people showing the enemies really who His people are. "In the presence of my enemies, you have prepared a table for me. You have blessed me." Now, how does that play itself out? Does that happen in our own lifetime? Does that happen only at the judgment, in eschatology, when all the sheep and goats are separated and so forth, and then it's made known? I don't know. Sometimes it may happen in our lifetime, sometimes it may not. I don't know exactly what happened and transpired with the Church of Philadelphia, but God is making sure that they know that there's going to come a day when He vindicates His people. And these Jews will know that God was with them, with the Christians. And He says also that I am going to preserve you from coming trials. He says in verse 10, "Because you have kept my command to persevere, I also will keep you from the hour of trial, which will come upon the whole world to test those who dwell on the earth. Behold, I am coming quickly." Now, do not think that this is something, end time. This is something that was going to be happening in their lifetime, or at least shortly thereafter. That's the message of the entire book, by the way, is that these things were shortly take place. They've already been through some persecution. Jesus says, "I'm going to keep you from more. I'm going to protect you from that." Now, the first question may be in your mind, I know it has been in mine every time I read this, is why does He say to the Church of Philadelphia, "I'm going to spare you from coming persecution"? But that church at Smyrna, which He also had nothing but good to say about, He said, "There's coming persecution, and you're going to be tried. You're going to be going through tribulation for 10 days. Some of you are going to die." Well, is that fair? Why does Philadelphia get spared, but Smyrna does not? I don't know. Other than God in His wisdom knows what we need and knows what's best. But regardless of whether we are spared, whether or not we have this preservation from trials, He says, "You hold fast. And as long as you overcome, then you will receive the reward." They had already been through some trials. They had already been through some persecution. So maybe because God knew they just could not handle any more, He was being merciful to them. He says they had a little strength. This would be a message of comfort to them that they were going to be spared some more trials. And then there's a message of establishment and security. When He says in verse 12, "He who overcomes, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God, and he shall go out no more." When you think of a pillar in a temple, you think of this major structure and this tall pillar that supports this structure. There is strength there. There is establishment there. Something that is unshakable. I don't know if this would be an allusion to the problems in Philadelphia or not, but some commentators think it is, and that is that there were major earthquakes in that area. And Philadelphia had been ravaged by earthquakes on more than one occasion. The buildings, we have records of them talking about how the buildings had cracks and were constantly having to be repaired and buildings falling down. In fact, many of the people didn't even live in the city. They lived in the outskirts, in farms and so forth, because they did not want to be where these structures were. They only came to the city for doing business and so forth. The idea here is you're going to be secure. You're going to be established. And you won't have to leave the city. You won't have to leave the structure and flee. No, you will be in my temple. You are in my kingdom. And I will give you a new name, or a name of my God, and the name of the city of my God, and I will give you my new name. That's identification with God. And that's the relationship with Jesus Christ. We call ourselves Christians. And the reason that we call ourselves Christians is because we are supposed to be disciples of Christ. We are followers of Christ. And so we have His name. We say that we are His people. Jesus is letting these Christians know, you are indeed my people. God considers you His people. This is a message of hope and comfort to these Christians. Wonderful promises that Jesus makes to them for those who are faithful, for he who overcomes. And he concludes with the familiar refrain, he who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. Here's the main lesson I want us to get from this letter to the Church of Philadelphia. Perseverance and obedience. Keep doing what you're doing. That is, if you are in fact being faithful to God. That is, in fact, if you are being obedient to Him. If you are indeed not denying Christ in some way. Now, remember, don't think of denying Christ in only the idea of, oh, I don't believe Christ exists, or I don't believe that He is the Messiah. That's not the only way we deny Christ. Anytime that we decide our will, that what we want to do is superior than what Jesus wants us to do, that's denying Christ. Anytime we elevate ourselves above the Word of Christ, we make ourselves God. We make ourselves the standard. That's denying Christ. Anytime we read what Jesus says and we know what He wants us to do, but then we go and do something different, we're denying Christ. If Jesus was to write a letter to us, what would He say? Would He say that we are being faithful to Him and to His Word and obedient to His Word, that we are persevering? Would He make the same type of promises to us? Those promises are available to everyone. Those promises are available to every group of Christians. But it's only to he who overcomes. We're not going to be saved, brethren. I hope that you see this as we have gone through these letters and as we look at the last one next Sunday. That just because we are associated with a particular church, that our name is on the roster, on the picture board out there, on the website, just because our name is there, that's not what saves us. There were people even within those churches that Jesus had a lot of bad to say, that he said, there are some who have not soiled their garments. So participation or involvement with a particular church does not either deny your salvation or guarantee your salvation. It's on an individual basis. But we have a work to do as a group of people. What would he say to us? And of course, more importantly, what would he say to you individually? Would he count you as one of his faithful? We certainly hope so. But if you are not sure about that, if you know that there is something that you are not doing, that you should be doing, maybe something you should be doing that you're not doing, if you are not being faithful to him, you need to correct that this morning. He said to those people that in his day, he was going to be coming quickly. There was a judgment coming. There's still a judgment coming. There's still a final judgment coming. Our life may end today. Don't wait. Make your life right with God right now. Together we stand and as we sing.